find her own fulfillment through the child. She fights desperately for control, no longer of herself perhaps, but of the child. The struggles over toilet training and weaning are generally battles in which she tries to redeem herself. The child becomes the real victim, victim of the mother's helplessness, which, in turn, creates an aggression in her that mounts to destruction. The only way for the child to survive is to retreat, to withdraw, not only from the dangerous mother, but from the whole world as well. And so he becomes a thing, or an animal, or a restless wanderer in search of no one and no place, weaving about the room, swaying back and forth, circling the walls as if they were bars he would break through. In this clinic, the doctors were often able to trace a similar pattern back several generations. The dehumanization was indeed progressive. In view of these clinical observations, we may assume that the conflict we have discovered in two generations may well have existed for generations before and will continue in those to come unless the pattern is interrupted by therapeutic intervention or the child rescued by a masculine father figure, a hope which our experience would not lead us to expect. But neither therapy nor love was enough to help these children if the mother continued to live vicariously through the child. I noticed the same pattern in many of the women I interviewed, women who dominated their daughters or bred them into passive dependence and conformity or unconsciously pushed them into sexual activities. One of the most tragic women I interviewed was the mother of that sleepwalking 13-year-old girl. A wealthy executive's wife, whose life was filled with all the trappings, she lived in the very image of suburban togetherness, except that it was only a shell. Her husband's real life was centered in his business, a life that he could not or would not share with his wife. She had sought to recapture her sense of life by unconsciously pushing her 13-year-old daughter into promiscuity. She lived in her daughter's pseudo-sex life, which, for the girl, was so devoid of actual feeling that she became in it merely a thing. Quite a few therapists and counselors were trying to help the mother and the father on the premise, I suppose, that if the mother's sexual-emotional needs were filled in her marriage by her husband, she would not need to solve them through her daughter, and her daughter could grow out of the thingness to womanhood herself. It was because the husband had so many problems of his own and the prospects of the mother ever getting enough love from him looked dim that the counselors were trying to get the mother to develop some real interest in her own life. But with other women I have encountered who have evaded their own growth in vicarious living and lack of personal purposes, not even the most loving of husbands have managed to stop the progressive damage to their own lives and the lives of their children. I have seen what happens when women unconsciously push their daughters into too early sexuality because a sexual adventure was the only real adventure or means of achieving status or identity in their own lives. Today, these daughters who acted out their mother's dreams or frustrated ambitions in the normal, feminine way and hitched their wagons to the rising stars of ambitious, able men are, in too many cases, as frustrated and unfulfilled as their mothers. They do not all rush barefoot to the police station for fear they will murder the husband and baby who they think trapped them in that house. All their sons do not become violent menaces in the neighborhood and at school. All their daughters do not act out their mother's sexual fantasies and become pregnant at 14. Nor do all such housewives begin drinking at 11 a.m. to hide the clunking whir of the dishwasher, the washing machine, the dryer, that are finally the only sounds of life in that empty house, as the children, one by one, go off to school. But in suburbs like Bergen County, the rate of separations increased a wild 100% during the 1950s, as the able, ambitious men kept on growing in the city while their wives evaded growth in vicarious living or non-commitment, fulfilling their feminine role at home. As long as the children were home, as long as the husband was there, the wives suffered increasingly severe illnesses but recovered. But in Bergen County during this decade, there was a drastic increase in suicides of women over 45 and of hospitalized women psychiatric patients whose children had grown up and left home. The housewives who had to be hospitalized and who did not recover quickly were, above all, those who had never developed their own abilities and work outside the home. The massive breakdown that may take place as more and more of these new young housewife mothers who are the products of the feminine mystique reach their 40s is still a matter of speculation. But the progressive infantilization of their sons and daughters, as it is mirrored in the rash of early marriages, has become an alarming fact. In March 1962, at the National Conference of the Child Study Association, the new early marriages and parenthood, which had formerly been considered an indication of improved emotional maturity in the younger generation, were at last recognized as a sign of increasing infantilization. The millions of American youngsters who, in the 1960s, were marrying before they were 20, betrayed an immaturity and emotional dependence which seeks marriage as a magic shortcut to adult status, a magic solution to problems they cannot face themselves, professionals in the child and family field agreed. These infantile brides and grooms were diagnosed as the victims of this generation's sick, sad love affair with their own children. Many girls will admit that they want to get married because they do not want to work any longer. They harbor dreams of being taken care of for the rest of their lives without worry, with just enough furnishing, to do little housework, interesting downtown shopping trips, happy children, and nice neighbors. The dream of a husband seems somehow less important, but in the fantasies of girls about marriage, it usually concerns a man who has the strength of an indestructible, reliable, powerful father and the gentleness, givingness, and self-sacrificing love of a good mother. Young men give as their reason for wanting to marry very often the desire to have a motherly woman in the house and regular sex just for the asking without trouble and bother. In fact, what is supposed to secure maturity and independence is in reality a concealed hope to secure dependency, to prolong the child-parent relationship with the privileges of being a child and with as little as possible of his limitations. And there were other ominous signs across the nation of mounting uncontrollable violence among young parents and their children trapped in that passive dependence. A psychiatrist reported that such wives were reacting to hostility from their husbands by becoming even more dependent and passive, until they sometimes became literally unable to move, to take a step, by themselves. This did not make their husbands treat them with more love, but more rage. And what was happening to the rage the wives did not dare to use against their husbands? Consider this recent news item, Time, July 20th, 1962, about the battered child syndrome. To many doctors, the incident is becoming distressingly familiar. A child, usually under 3, is brought to the office with multiple fractures, often including a fractured skull. The parents express appropriate concern, report that the child fell out of bed or tumbled down the stairs or was injured by a playmate. But x-rays and experience lead the doctor to a different conclusion. The child has been beaten by his parents. Gathering documentation from 71 hospitals, a University of Colorado team found 302 battered child cases in a single year. 33 died, 85 suffered permanent brain damage. The parents who were driven to kick and punch their children, twist their arms, beat them with hammers or the buckle end of belts, burn them with cigarettes or electric irons, were as likely to live in those suburban split levels as in tenements. The AMA predicted that when statistics on the battered child syndrome are complete, it is likely that it will be found to be a more frequent cause of death in such well-recognized and thoroughly studied diseases as leukemia, cystic fibrosis, and muscular dystrophy. The parent with most opportunity to beat that battered child was, of course, the mother. As one young mother of 4 said to the doctor as she confessed to the wish to kill herself, "There doesn't seem to be any reason for me to go on living. I don't have anything to look forward to. Jim and I don't even talk to each other anymore except about the bills and things that need to be fixed in the house. I know he resents being so old and tied down when he's still young, and he blames it on me because it was I that wanted us to get married then. But the worst thing is, I feel so envious of my own children. I almost hate them because they have their lives ahead, and mine is over." It may or may not be a symbolic coincidence, but the same week the child and family profession recognized the real significance of the early marriages, the New York Times Book Review, Sunday, March 18, 1962, recorded a new and unprecedented popularity among American adults of books about love affairs between human beings and animals. In half a century, there have not been as many books about animals on the American bestseller lists as in the last 3 years, 1959 to 62. While animals have always dominated the literature for small children, with maturity, human beings become more interested in other human beings. It is only a symbol, but in the Rorschach test, a preponderance of animal over human images is a sign of infantilism. And so progressive dehumanization has carried the American mind in the last 15 years from youth worship to that sick love affair with our own children, from preoccupation with the physical details of sex, divorced from a human framework, to a love affair between man and animal. Where will it end? I think it will not end, as long as the feminine mystique masks the emptiness of the housewife role, encouraging girls to evade their own growth by vicarious living, by non-commitment. We have gone on too long blaming or pitying the mothers who devour their children, who sow the seeds of progressive dehumanization because they have never grown to full humanity themselves. If the mother is at fault, why isn't it time to break the pattern by urging all these sleeping beauties to grow up and live their own lives? There never will be enough Prince Charmings or enough therapists to break that pattern now. It is society's job, and finally that of each woman alone. For it is not the strength of the mothers that is at fault, but their weakness, their passive childlike dependency, and immaturity that is mistaken for femininity. Our society forces boys, insofar as it can, to grow up, to endure the pains of growth, to educate themselves, to work, to move on. Why aren't girls forced to grow up, to achieve somehow the core of self that will end the unnecessary dilemma, the mistaken choice between femaleness and humanness that is implied in the feminine mystique? It is time to stop exhorting mothers to love their children more and face the paradox between the mystique's demand that women devote themselves completely to their home and their children and the fact that most of the problems now being treated in child guidance clinics are solved only when the mothers are helped to develop autonomous interests of their own and no longer need to fill their emotional needs through their children. It is time to stop exhorting women to be more feminine when it breeds a passivity and dependence that depersonalizes sex and imposes an impossible burden on their husbands, a growing passivity in their sons. It is not an exaggeration to call the stagnating state of millions of American housewives a sickness, a disease in the shape of a progressively weaker core of human self that is being handed down to their sons and daughters at a time when the dehumanizing aspects of modern mass culture make it necessary for men and women to have a strong core of self, strong enough to retain human individuality through the frightening, unpredictable pressures of our changing environment. The strength of women is not the cause, but the cure for the sickness. Only when women are permitted to use their full strength to grow to their full capacities can the feminine mystique be shattered and the progressive dehumanization of their children be stopped. And most women can no longer use their full strength, grow to their full human capacity as housewives. It is urgent to understand how the very condition of being a housewife can create a sense of emptiness, non-existence, nothingness in women. There are aspects of the housewife role that make it almost impossible for a woman of adult intelligence to retain a sense of human identity, the firm core of self or I, without which a human being, man or woman, is not truly alive. For women of ability in America today, I am convinced there is something about the housewife state itself that is dangerous. In a sense that is not as far-fetched as it sounds, the women who adjust as housewives, who grow up wanting to be just a housewife, are in as much danger as the millions who walk to their own death in the concentration camps, and the millions more who refuse to believe that the concentration camps existed. In fact, there is an uncanny, uncomfortable insight into why a woman can so easily lose her sense of self as a housewife in certain psychological observations made of the behavior of prisoners in Nazi concentration camps. In these settings purposely contrived for the dehumanization of man, the prisoners literally became walking corpses. Those who adjusted to the conditions of the camps surrendered their human identity and went almost indifferently to their deaths. Strangely enough, the conditions which destroyed the human identity of so many prisoners were not the torture and the brutality, but conditions similar to those which destroy the identity of the American housewife. In the concentration camps, the prisoners were forced to adopt childlike behavior, forced to give up their individuality and merge themselves into an amorphous mass. Their capacity for self-determination, their ability to predict the future and to prepare for it, was systematically destroyed. It was a gradual process which occurred in virtually imperceptible stages, but at the end, with the destruction of adult self-respect, of an adult frame of reference, the dehumanizing process was complete. This was the process as observed by Bruno Bettelheim, psychoanalyst and educational psychologist, when he was a prisoner at Dachau and Buchenwald in 1939. When they entered the concentration camp, prisoners were almost traumatically cut off from their past adult interests. This in itself was a major blow to their identity over and above their physical confinement. A few, though only a few, were able to work privately in some way that had interested them in the past, but to do this alone was difficult, even to talk about these larger adult interests or to show some initiative in pursuing them aroused the hostility of other prisoners. New prisoners tried to keep their old interests alive, but old prisoners seemed mainly concerned with the problem of how to live as well as possible inside the camp. To old prisoners, the world of the camp was the only reality. They were reduced to childlike preoccupation with food, elimination, the satisfaction of primitive bodily needs. They had no privacy and no stimulation from the outside world. But above all, they were forced to spend their days in work, which produced great fatigue, not because it was physically killing, but because it was monotonous, endless, required no mental concentration, gave no hope of advancement or recognition, was sometimes senseless, and was controlled by the needs of others or the tempo of machines. It was work that did not emanate from the prisoner's own personality. It permitted no real initiative, no expression of the self, not even a real demarcation of time. And the more the prisoners gave up their adult human identity, the more they were preoccupied with the fear that they were losing their sexual potency, and the more preoccupied they became with the simplest animal needs. It brought them comfort at first to surrender their individuality and lose themselves in the anonymity of the mass, to feel that everyone was in the same boat. But strangely enough, under these conditions, real friendships did not grow. Even conversation, which was the prisoner's favorite pastime and did much to make life bearable, soon ceased to have any real meaning. So rage mounted in them. But the rage of the millions that could have knocked down the barbed wire fences and the SS guns was turned instead against themselves and against the prisoners even weaker than they. Then they felt even more powerless than they were, and saw the SS and the fences as even more impregnable than they were. It was said finally that not the SS, but the prisoners themselves became their own worst enemy. Because they cannot bear to see their situation as it really was. Because they denied the very reality of their problem and finally adjusted to the camp itself, as if it were the only reality, they were caught in the prison of their own minds. The guns of the SS were not powerful enough to keep all those prisoners subdued. They were manipulated to trap themselves. They imprisoned themselves by making the concentration camp the whole world, by blinding themselves to the larger world of the past, their responsibility for the present, and their possibilities for the future. The ones who survived, who neither died nor were exterminated, were the ones who retained in some essential degree the adult values and interests which had been the essence of their past identity. All this seems terribly remote from the easy life of the American suburban housewife, but is her house in reality a comfortable concentration camp? Have not women who live in the image of the feminine mystique trapped themselves within the narrow walls of their homes? They have learned to adjust to their biological role. They have become dependent, passive, childlike. They have given up their adult frame of reference to live at the lower human level of food and things. The work they do does not require adult capabilities. It is endless, monotonous, unrewarding. American women are not, of course, being ready for mass extermination, but they are suffering a slow death of mind and spirit. Just as with the prisoners in the concentration camps, there are American women who have resisted that death, who have managed to retain a core of self, who have not lost touch with the outside world, who use their abilities to some creative purpose. They are women of spirit and intelligence who have refused to adjust as housewives. It has been said time and time again that education has kept American women from adjusting to their role as housewives. But if education, which serves human growth, which distills what the human mind has discovered and created in the past, and gives man the ability to create his own future, if education has made more and more American women feel trapped, frustrated, guilty as housewives, surely this should be seen as a clear signal that women have outgrown the housewife role. It is not possible to preserve one's identity by adjusting for any length of time to a frame of reference that is in itself destructive to it. It is very hard indeed for a human being to sustain such an inner split, conforming outwardly to one reality while trying to maintain inwardly the values it denies. The comfortable concentration camp that American women have walked into or have been talked into by others is just such a reality, a frame of reference that denies women's adult human identity. By adjusting to it, a woman stunts her intelligence and becomes childlike, turns away from individual identity to become an anonymous biological robot in a docile mass. She becomes less than human, preyed upon by outside pressures, and herself preying upon her husband and children. And the longer she conforms, the less she feels as if she really exists. She looks for her security in things. She hides the fear of losing her human potency by testing her sexual potency. She lives a vicarious life through mass daydreams or through her husband and children. She does not want to be reminded of the outside world. She becomes convinced there is nothing she can do about her own life or the world that would make a difference. But no matter how often she tries to tell herself that this giving up of personal identity is a necessary sacrifice for her children and husband, it serves no real purpose. So the aggressive energy she should be using in the world becomes instead the terrible anger that she dare not turn against her husband, is ashamed of turning against her children, and finally turns against herself until she feels as if she does not exist. And yet in the comfortable concentration camp, as in the real one, something very strong in a woman resists the death of herself. Describing an unforgettable experience in a real concentration camp, Bettelheim tells of a group of naked prisoners, no longer human, merely docile robots, who were lined up to enter the gas chamber. The SS commanding officer, learning that one of the women prisoners had been a dancer, ordered her to dance for him. She did, and as she danced, she approached him, seized his gun, and shot him down. She was immediately shot to death, but Bettelheim is moved to ask, "Isn't it probable that despite the grotesque setting in which she danced, dancing made her once again a person? Dancing, she was singled out as an individual, asked to perform in what had been once her chosen vocation. No longer was she a number, a nameless depersonalized prisoner, but the dancer she used to be. Transformed, however, momentarily, she responded like her old self, destroying the enemy bent on her destruction, even if she had to die in the process." Despite the hundreds of thousands of living dead men who moved quietly to their graves, this one example shows that in an instant, the old personality can be regained, its destruction undone, once we decide on our own that we wish to cease being units in a system. Exercising the lost freedom that not even the concentration camp could take away, to decide how one wishes to think and feel about the conditions of one's life, this dancer threw off her real prison. This she could do because she was willing to risk her life to achieve autonomy once more. The suburban house is not a German concentration camp, nor are American housewives on their way to the gas chamber. But they are in a trap, and to escape they must, like the dancer, finally exercise their human freedom and recapture their sense of self. They must refuse to be nameless, depersonalized, manipulated, and live their own lives again according to a self-chosen purpose. They must begin to grow. Chapter 13. The Forfeited Self. Scientists of human behavior have become increasingly interested in the basic human need to grow, man's will to be all that is in him to be. Thinkers in many fields, from Bergson to Kurt Goldstein, Heinz Hartmann, Alport, Rogers, Jung, Adler, Rank, Horney, Engel, Fromm, May, Maslow, Bettelheim, Reisman, Tillich, and all the existentialists, all postulate some positive growth tendency within the organism, which from within drives it to fuller development, to self-realization. This will to power, self-assertion, dominance, or autonomy, as it is variously called, does not imply aggression or competitive striving in the usual sense. It is the individual affirming his existence and his potentialities as a being in his own right. It is the courage to be an individual. Moreover, many of these thinkers have advanced a new concept of the psychologically healthy man and of normality and pathology. Normality is considered to be the highest excellence of which we are capable. The premise is that man is happy, self-accepting, healthy, without guilt, only when he is fulfilling himself and becoming what he can be. In this new psychological thinking, which seeks to understand what makes men human and defines neuroses in terms of that which destroys man's capacity to fulfill his own being, the significant tense is the future. It is not enough for an individual to be loved and accepted by others, to be adjusted to his culture. He must take his existence seriously enough to make his own commitment to life and to the future. He forfeits his existence by failing to fulfill his entire being. For years, psychiatrists have tried to cure their patients' conflicts by fitting them to the culture. But adjustment to a culture which does not permit the realization of one's entire being is not a cure at all, according to the new psychological thinkers. Then the patient accepts a confined world without conflict, for now his world is identical with the culture. And since anxiety comes only with freedom, the patient naturally gets over his anxiety. He is relieved from his symptoms because he surrenders the possibilities which caused his anxiety. There is certainly a question how far this gaining of release from conflict by giving up being can proceed without generating in individuals and groups a submerged despair, a resentment which will later burst out in self-destructiveness. For history proclaims again and again that sooner or later man's need to be free will out. These thinkers may not know how accurately they are describing the kind of adjustment that has been inflicted on American housewives. What they are describing as unseen self-destruction in man is, I think, no less destructive in women who adjust to the feminine mystique, who expect to live through their husbands and children, who want only to be loved and secure, to be accepted by others, who never make a commitment to their own society or to the future, who never realize their human potential. The adjusted or cured ones who live without conflict or anxiety in the confined world of home have forfeited their own being. The others, the miserable, frustrated ones, still have some hope. For the problem that has no name, from which so many women in America suffer today, is caused by adjustment to an image that does not permit them to become what they now can be. It is the growing despair of women who have forfeited their own existence, although by doing so, they may have also evaded that lonely, frightened feeling that always comes with freedom. Anxiety occurs at the point where some emerging potentiality or possibility faces the individual, some possibility of fulfilling his existence. But this very possibility involves the destroying of present security, which thereupon gives rise to the tendency to deny the new potentiality. The new thinking, which is by no means confined to existentialists, would not analyze away a person's guilt over refusing to accept the intellectual and spiritual possibilities of his existence. Not all feelings of human guilt are unfounded. Guilt over the murder of another is not to be analyzed away, nor is guilt over the murder of oneself. As was said of a man, the patient was guilty because he had locked up some essential potentialities in himself. The failure to realize the full possibilities of their existence has not been studied as a pathology in women, for it is considered normal feminine adjustment in America and in most countries of the world. But one could apply to millions of women adjusted to the housewife's role the insights of neurologists and psychiatrists who have studied male patients with portions of their brain shot away and schizophrenics who have, for other reasons, forfeited their ability to relate to the real world. Such patients are seen now to have lost the unique mark of the human being, the capacity to transcend the present and to act in the light of the possible, the mysterious capacity to shape the future. It is precisely this unique human capacity to transcend the present, to live one's life by purposes stretching into the future, to live not at the mercy of the world, but as a builder and designer of that world, that is the distinction between animal and human behavior, or between the human being and the machine. In his study of soldiers who had sustained brain injuries, Dr. Kurt Goldstein found that what they lost was no more nor less than the ability of abstract human thought. To think in terms of the possible, to order the chaos of concrete detail with an idea, to move according to a purpose. These men were tied to the immediate situation in which they found themselves. Their sense of time and space was drastically curtailed. They had lost their human freedom. A similar daliness shrinks the world of a depressed schizophrenic to whom each day was a separate island with no past and no future. When such a patient has a terrifying delusion that his execution is imminent, it is the result, not the cause, of his own distorted attitude toward the future. There was no action or desire which, emanating from the present, reached out to the future, spanning the dull, similar days. As a result, each day kept an unusual independence. Failing to be immersed in the perception of any life continuity, each day life began anew, like a solitary island in a gray sea of passing time. There seemed to be no wish to go further. Every day was an exasperating monotony of the same words, the same complaints, until one felt that this being had lost all sense of necessary continuity. His attention was short-lived, and he seemed unable to go beyond the most banal questions. Recent experimental work by various psychologists reveals that sheep can bind past and future into the present for a span of about 15 minutes, and dogs for half an hour. But a human being can bring the past of thousands of years ago into the present as guide to his personal actions and can project himself in imagination into the future, not only for half an hour, but for weeks and years. This capacity to transcend the immediate boundaries of time, to act and react, and see one's experience in the dimensions of both past and future, is the unique characteristic of human existence. The brain-injured soldiers thus were doomed to the inhuman hell of eternal dailiness. The housewives who suffer the terror of the problem that has no name are victims of the same deadly dailiness. As one of them told me, "I can take the real problems. It's the endless boring days that make me desperate." Housewives who live according to the feminine mystique do not have a personal purpose stretching into the future. But without such a purpose to evoke their full abilities, they cannot grow to self-realization. Without such a purpose, they lose the sense of who they are, for it is purpose which gives the human pattern to one's days. American housewives have not had their brains shot away, nor are they schizophrenic in the clinical sense. But if this new thinking is right, and the fundamental human drive is not the urge for pleasure or the satisfaction of biological needs, but the need to grow and to realize one's full potential, the comfortable, empty, purposeless days are indeed cause for a nameless terror. In the name of femininity, they have evaded the choices that would have given them a personal purpose, a sense of their own being. For, as the existentialists say, the values of human life never come about automatically. The human being can lose his own being by his own choices, as a tree or stone cannot. It is surely as true of women's whole human potential what earlier psychological theorists have only deemed true of her sexual potential, that if she is barred from realizing her true nature, she will be sick. The frustration not only of needs like sex, but of individual abilities could result in neurosis. Her anxiety can be soothed by therapy or tranquilized by pills or evaded temporarily by busy work. But her unease, her desperation, is nonetheless a warning that her human existence is in danger, even though she has found fulfillment, according to the tenets of the feminine mystique, as a wife and mother. Only recently have we come to accept the fact that there is an evolutionary scale or hierarchy of needs in man and thus in woman, ranging from the needs usually called instincts because they are shared with animals, to needs that come later in human development. These later needs, the needs for knowledge, for self-realization, are as instinctive in a human sense as a need shared with other animals of food, sex, survival. The clear emergence of the latter needs seems to rest upon prior satisfaction of the physiological needs. The man who is extremely and dangerously hungry has no other interest but food. Capacities not useful for the satisfying of hunger are pushed into the background. But what happens to man's desire when there is plenty of food and his belly is chronically filled? At once other and higher needs emerge, and these, rather than the physiological hungers, dominate the organism. In a sense, this evolving hierarchy of needs moves further and further away from the physiological level, which depends on the material environment and tends toward a level relatively independent of the environment, more and more self-determined. But a man can be fixated on a lower need level. Higher needs can be confused or channeled into the old avenues and may never emerge. The progress leading finally to the highest human level is easily blocked. Blocked by deprivation of a lower need, as the need for food or sex. Blocked also by channeling all existence into these lower needs and refusing to recognize that higher needs exist. In our culture, the development of women has been blocked at the physiological level with, in many cases, no need recognized higher than the need for love or sexual satisfaction. Even the need for self-respect, for self-esteem, and for the esteem of others, the desire for strength, for achievement, for adequacy, for mastery and competence, for confidence in the face of the world, and for independence and freedom, is not clearly recognized for women. But certainly the thwarting of the need for self-esteem, which produces feelings of inferiority, of weakness, and of helplessness in man, can have the same effect on woman. Self-esteem in woman, as well as in man, can only be based on real capacity, competence, and achievement. Undeserved respect from others rather than unwarranted adulation. Despite the glorification of occupation housewife, if that occupation does not demand or permit realization of woman's full abilities, it cannot provide adequate self-esteem, much less pave the way to a higher level of self-realization. We are living through a period in which a great many of the higher human needs are reduced to, or are seen as, symbolic workings out of the sexual need. A number of advanced thinkers now seriously question such explanations by reduction. While every kind of sexual symbolism and emotional pathology can be found by those who explore, with this aim, the works in early life of a Shakespeare, a Da Vinci, a Lincoln, an Einstein, a Freud, or a Tolstoy, these reductions do not explain the work that lived beyond the man, the unique creation that was his, and not that of a man suffering a similar pathology. But the sexual symbol is easier to see than sex itself as a symbol. If women's needs for identity, for self-esteem, for achievement, and finally for expression of her unique human individuality are not recognized by herself or others in our culture, she is forced to seek identity and self-esteem in the only channels open to her, the pursuit of sexual fulfillment, motherhood, and the possession of material things. And, chained to these pursuits, she is stunted at a lower level of living, blocked from the realization of her higher human needs. Of course, little is known about the pathology or the dynamics of these higher human needs, the desire to know and understand, the search for knowledge, truth, and wisdom, the urge to solve the cosmic mysteries, because they are not important in the clinic in the medical tradition of curing disease. Compared to the symptoms of the classical neurosis, such as the ones Freud saw as emanating from the repression of the sexual need, this kind of psychopathology would be pale, subtle, and easily overlooked, or defined as normal. But it is a fact, documented by history, if not in the clinic or laboratory, that man has always searched for knowledge and truth, even in the face of the greatest danger. Further, recent studies of psychologically healthy people have shown that this search, this concern with great questions, is one of the defining characteristics of human health. There is something less than fully human in those who have never known a commitment to an idea, who have never risked an exploration of the unknown, who have never attempted the kind of creativity of which men and women are potentially capable. As A.H. Maslow puts it, capacities clamor to be used and cease their clamor only when they are well used. That is, capacities are also needs. Not only is it fun to use our capacities, but it is also necessary. The unused capacity or organ can become a disease center or else atrophy, thus diminishing the person. But women in America are not encouraged or expected to use their full capacities. In the name of femininity, they are encouraged to evade human growth. Growth has not only rewards and pleasure, but also many intrinsic pains and always will have. Each step forward is a step into the unfamiliar and is thought of as possibly dangerous. It also frequently means giving up something familiar and good and satisfying. It frequently means a parting and a separation with consequent nostalgia, loneliness, and mourning. It also often means giving up a simpler and easier and less effortful life in exchange for a more demanding, more difficult life. Growth forward is in spite of these losses and therefore requires courage, strength in the individual, as well as protection, permission, and encouragement from the environment, especially for the child. What happens if the environment frowns on that courage and strength, sometimes virtually forbids and seldom actually encourages that growth in the child who is a girl? What happens if human growth is considered antagonistic to femininity, to fulfillment as a woman, to woman's sexuality? The feminine mystique implies a choice between being a woman or risking the pains of human growth. Thousands of women, reduced to biological living by their environment, lulled into a false sense of anonymous security in their comfortable concentration camps, have made a wrong choice. The irony of their mistaken choice is this. The mystique holds out feminine fulfillment as the prize for being only a wife and mother. But it is no accident that thousands of suburban housewives have not found that prize. The simple truth would seem to be that women will never know sexual fulfillment and the peak experience of human love until they are allowed and encouraged to grow to their full strength as human beings. For according to the new psychological theorists, self-realization, far from preventing the highest sexual fulfillment, is inextricably linked to it. And there is more than theoretical reason to believe that this is as true for women as for men. In the late 30s, Professor Maslow began to study the relationship between sexuality and what he called dominance feeling, or self-esteem, or ego level, in women. 130 women of college education or of comparable intelligence between 20 and 28, most of whom were married, of Protestant middle-class city background. He found, contrary to what one might expect from the psychoanalytical theories and the conventional images of femininity, that the more dominant the woman, the greater her enjoyment of sexuality, and the greater her ability to submit, in a psychological sense, to give herself freely in love, to have orgasm. It was not that these women higher in dominance were more highly sexed, but they were, above all, more completely themselves, more free to be themselves, and this seemed inextricably linked with a greater freedom to give themselves in love. These women were not, in the usual sense, feminine, but they enjoyed sexual fulfillment to a much higher degree than the conventionally feminine women in the same study. I have never seen the implications of this research discussed in popular psychological literature about femininity or women's sexuality. It was perhaps not noticed at the time, even by the theorists, as a major landmark. But its findings are thought-provoking for American women today who lead their lives according to the dictates of the feminine mystique. Remember that this study was done in the late 1930s, before the mystique became all-powerful. For these strong, spirited, educated women, evidently there was no conflict between the driving force to be themselves and to love. Here is the way Professor Maslow contrasted these women with their more feminine sisters in terms of themselves and in terms of their sexuality. High dominance feeling involves good self-confidence, self-assurance, high evaluation of the self, feelings of general capability or superiority, and lack of shyness, timidity, self-consciousness, or embarrassment. Low dominance feeling involves lack of self-confidence, self-assurance, and self-esteem. Instead, there are extensive feelings of general and specific inferiority, shyness, timidity, fearfulness, self-consciousness. The person who describes herself as completely lacking in what she may call self-confidence in general will describe herself as self-confident in her home, cooking, sewing, or being a mother, but almost always underestimates to a greater or lesser degree her specific abilities and endowments. The high dominance person usually gauges her abilities accurately and realistically. These high dominance women were not feminine in the conventional sense, partly because they felt free to choose rather than be bound by convention, and partly because they were stronger as individuals than most women. Such women prefer to be treated like a person, not like a woman. They prefer to be independent, stand on their own 2 feet, and generally do not care for concessions that imply they are inferior, weak, or that they need special attention and cannot take care of themselves. This is not to imply that they cannot behave conventionally. They do when it is necessary or desirable for any reason, but they do not take the ordinary conventions seriously. A common phrase is, "I could be nice and sweet and clinging vine as anyone else, but my tongue is in my cheek." Rules per se generally mean nothing to these women. It is only when they approve of the rules and can see and approve of the purpose behind them that they will obey them. They are strong, purposeful, and do live by rules, but these rules are autonomous and personally arrived at. Low dominance women are very different. They usually do not dare break the rules, even when they rarely disapprove of them. Their morality and ethics are usually entirely conventional. That is, they do what they have been taught to do by their parents, their teachers, or their religion. The dictum of authority is usually not questioned openly, and they are more apt to approve of the status quo in every field of life, religious, economic, educational, and political. Professor Maslow found that the higher the dominance or strength of self in a woman, the less she was self-centered, and the more her concern was directed outward to other people and to problems of the world. On the other hand, the main preoccupation of the more conventionally feminine low-dominance women was themselves and their own inferiorities. From a psychological point of view, a high-dominance woman was more like a high-dominance man than she was like a low-dominance woman. Thus, Professor Maslow suggested that either you have to describe as masculine both high-dominance men and women, or drop the terms masculine and feminine altogether because they are so misleading. Our high-dominance women feel more akin to men than to women in tastes, attitudes, prejudices, aptitudes, philosophy, and inner personality in general. Many of the qualities that are considered in our culture to be manly are seen in them in high degree, for example, leadership, strength of character, strong social purpose, emancipation from trivialities, lack of fear, shyness, etc. They do not ordinarily care to be housewives or cooks alone, but wish to combine marriage with a career. Their salary may come to no more than the salary of a housekeeper, but they feel other work to be more important than sewing, cooking, etc. Above all, the high-dominance woman was more psychologically free, more autonomous. The low-dominance woman was not free to be herself. She was other-directed. The more her self-depreciation, self-distrust, the more likely she was to feel another's opinion more valid than her own, and to wish she were more like someone else. Such women usually admire and respect others more than they do themselves. And along with this tremendous respect for authority, with idolization and imitation of others, with the complete voluntary subordination to others, and the great respect for others, went hatred and resentment, envy, jealousy, suspicion, distrust. Where the high-dominance women were freely angry, the low-dominance women did not have nerve enough to say what they think, and courage enough to show anger when it is necessary. Thus their feminine quietness was a concomitant of shyness, inferiority feelings, and a general feeling that anything they could say would be stupid and would be laughed at. Such a woman does not want to be a leader, except in her fantasies, for she is afraid of being in the forefront, she is afraid of responsibility, and she feels that she would be incompetent. And again, Professor Maslow found an evident link between the strength of self and sexuality, the freedom to be oneself, and the freedom to submit. He found that the women who were timid, shy, modest, neat, tactful, quiet, introverted, retiring, more feminine, more conventional, were not capable of enjoying the kind of sexual fulfillment which was freely enjoyed by women high in dominance and self-esteem. It would seem as if every sexual impulse or desire that has ever been spoken of may emerge freely and without inhibition in these women. Generally, the sexual act is apt to be taken not as a serious rite with fearful aspects and differing in fundamental quality from all other acts, but as a game, as fun, as a highly pleasurable animal act. Moreover, Maslow found that even in dreams and fantasies, women of above-average dominance enjoyed a sexuality, while in low-dominance women, the sexual dreams are always of the romantic sort, or else are anxious, distorted, symbolized, and concealed. Do the makers of the mystique overlook such strong and sexually joyous women when they define passivity and renunciation of personal achievement and activity in the world as the price of feminine sexual fulfillment? Perhaps Freud and his followers did not see such women in their clinics when they created that image of passive femininity. Perhaps the strength of self, which Maslow found in the cases he studied, was a new phenomenon in women. The mystique kept even the behavioral scientists from exploring the relationship between sex and self in women in the ensuing era. But, quite aside from questions of women, in recent years, behavioral scientists have become increasingly uneasy about basing their image of human nature on a study of its diseased or stunted specimens, patients in the clinic. In this context, Professor Maslow later set about to study people, dead and alive, who showed no evidence of neurosis, psychosis, or psychopathic personality people who, in his view, showed positive evidence of self-realization or self-actualization, which he defined as the full use and exploitation of talents, capacities, potentialities. Such people seem to be fulfilling themselves and to be doing the best that they are capable of doing. There are people who have developed or are developing to the full stature of which they are capable. There are many things that emerge from this study which bear directly on the problem of women in America today. For one thing, among the public figures included in this study, Professor Maslow was able to find only two women who had actually fulfilled themselves, Eleanor Roosevelt and Jane Addams. The men included Lincoln, Jefferson, Einstein, Freud, G.W. Carver, Debs, Schweitzer, Chrysler, Goethe, Thoreau, William James, Spinoza, Whitman, Franklin Roosevelt, Beethoven. Apart from public and historical figures, he studied at close range a small number of unnamed subjects who met his criteria, all in their 50s and 60s. And he screened 3,000 college students, finding only 20 who seemed to be developing in the direction of self-actualization. Here also, there were very few women. As a matter of fact, his findings implied that self-actualization, or the full realization of human potential, was hardly possible at all for women in our society. Professor Maslow found in his study that self-actualizing people invariably have a commitment, a sense of mission in life that makes them live in a very large human world, a frame of reference beyond privatism and preoccupation with the petty details of daily life. These individuals customarily have some mission in life, some task to fulfill, some problem outside themselves, which enlists much of their energies. In general, these tasks are non-personal or unselfish, concerned rather with the good of mankind in general, or of a nation in general. Ordinarily concerned with basic issues and eternal questions, such people live customarily in the widest possible frame of reference. They work within a framework of values that are broad and not petty, universal and not local, and in terms of a century rather than a moment. Further, Professor Maslow saw that self-actualizing people who live in a larger world somehow thereby never stale in their enjoyment of the day-to-day living, the trivialities which can become unbearably chafing to those for whom they are the only world. They have a wonderful capacity to appreciate again and again, freshly and naively, the basic goods of life with awe, pleasure, wonder, and even ecstasy, however stale these experiences may have become to others. He also reported the very strong impression that the sexual pleasures are found in their most intense and ecstatic perfection in self-actualizing people. It seems as if fulfillment of personal capacity in this larger world opened new vistas of sexual ecstasy, and yet sex or even love was not the driving purpose in their lives. In self-actualizing people, the orgasm is simultaneously more important and less important than in average people. It is often a profound and almost mystical experience, and yet the absence of sexuality is more easily tolerated by these people. Loving at a higher need level makes the lower needs and their frustrations and satisfactions less important, less central, more easily neglected. But it also makes them more wholeheartedly enjoyed when gratified. Food is simultaneously enjoyed and yet regarded as relatively unimportant in the total scheme of life. Sex can be wholeheartedly enjoyed far beyond the possibility of the average person, even at the same time that it does not play a central role in the philosophy of life. It is something to be enjoyed, something to be taken for granted, something to build upon, something that is very basically important like water or food, and that can be enjoyed as much as these, but gratification should be taken for granted. With such people, the sexual orgasm is not always a mystical experience. It may also be taken rather lightly, bringing fun, merriment, elation, feeling of well-being, gaiety. It is cheerful, humorous, and playful, and not primarily a striving. It is basically an enjoyment and a delight. He also found in contradiction both to the conventional view and to esoteric theorists of sex that in self-actualizing people, the quality of both love and sexual satisfaction improves with the age of the relationship. It is a very common report from these individuals that sex is better than it used to be and seems to be improving all the time. For as such a person with the years becomes more and more himself and truer to himself, he seems also to have deeper and more profound relations with others, to be capable of more fusion, greater love, more perfect identification with others, more transcendence of the boundaries of the self, without ever giving up his own individuality. What we see is a fusion of great ability to love and at the same time great respect for the other and great respect for oneself. Throughout the most intense and ecstatic love affairs, these people remain themselves and remain ultimately masters of themselves as well, living by their own standards, even though enjoying each other intensely. In our society, love has customarily been defined, at least for women, as a complete merging of egos and a loss of separateness, togetherness, a giving up of individuality rather than a strengthening of it. But in the love of self-actualizing people, Maslow found that the individuality is strengthened, that the ego is in one sense merged with another, but yet in another sense remains separate and strong as always. The two tendencies, to transcend individuality and to sharpen and strengthen it, must be seen as partners and not as contradictory. He also found in the love of self-actualizing people the tendency to more and more complete spontaneity, the dropping of defenses, growing intimacy, honesty, and self-expression. These people found it possible to be themselves, to feel natural. They could be psychologically as well as physically naked and still feel loved and wanted and secure. They could let their faults, weaknesses, physical and psychological shortcomings be freely seen. They did not always have to put their best foot forward to hide false teeth, gray hairs, signs of age. They did not have to work continually at their relationships. There was much less mystery and glamour, much less reserve and concealment and secrecy. In such people, there did not seem to be hostility between the sexes. In fact, he found that such people made no really sharp differentiation between the roles and personalities of the two sexes. That is, they did not assume that the female was passive and the male active, whether in sex or love or anything else. These people were also certain of their maleness or femaleness that they did not mind taking on some of the cultural aspects of the opposite sex role. It was especially noteworthy that they could be both active and passive lovers, and this was the clearest in the sexual act and in physical lovemaking. Kissing and being kissed, being above or below in the sexual act, taking the initiative, being quiet and receiving love, teasing and being teased. These were all found in both sexes. And thus, while in the conventional and even in the sophisticated view, masculine and feminine love, active and passive, seem to be at opposite poles in self-actualizing people, the dichotomies are resolved and the individual becomes both active and passive, both selfish and unselfish, both masculine and feminine, both self-interested and self-effacing. Love for self-actualizing people differed from the conventional definition of love in yet another way. It was not motivated by need to make up a deficiency in the self. It was more purely gift love, a kind of spontaneous admiration. Such disinterested admiration and love used to be considered a superhuman ability, not a natural human one. But as Maslow says, human beings at their best, fully grown, show many characteristics one thought in an earlier era to be supernatural prerogatives. And there, in the words fully grown, is the clue to the mystery of the problem that has no name. The transcendence of self in sexual orgasm, as in creative experience, can only be attained by one who is himself or herself complete, by one who has realized his or her own identity. The theorists know this is true for man, though they have never thought through the implications for women. The suburban doctors, gynecologists, obstetricians, child guidance clinicians, pediatricians, marriage counselors, and ministers who treat women's problems have all seen it, without putting a name to it or even reporting it as a phenomenon. What they have seen confirms that for woman, as for man, the need for self-fulfillment, autonomy, self-realization, independence, individuality, self-actualization, is as important as the sexual need, with the serious consequences when it is thwarted. Woman's sexual problems are, in this sense, byproducts of the suppression of her basic need to grow and fulfill her potentialities as a human being, potentialities which the mystique of feminine fulfillment ignores. Psychoanalysts have long suspected that woman's intelligence does not fully flower when she denies her sexual nature, but by the same token, can her sexual nature fully flower when she must deny her intelligence, her highest human potential? All the words that have been written criticizing American women for castrating their husbands and sons, for dominating their children, for their material greediness, for their sexual frigidity or denial of femininity may simply mask this one underlying fact. That woman, no more than man, can live by sex alone. That her struggle for identity, autonomy, that personally productive orientation based on the human need for active participation in a creative task is inextricably linked with her sexual fulfillment as a condition of her maturity. In the attempt to live by sex alone, in the image of the feminine mystique, ultimately she must castrate the husband and sons who can never give her enough satisfaction to make up for lack of a self, and pass on to her daughters her own unspoken disappointment, self-denigration, and discontent. Professor Maslow told me that he thought self-actualization is only possible